Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Leighton Ford wasn't born a Southerner, but surely by now he qualifies. He's lived in Charlotte more than 60 years. Before then, back home in Canada, he met a young preacher named Billy Graham. He ended up not just working with Graham, but marrying his sister Jeannie. He went on to his own career as a teacher and mentor to young evangelists. But he and Billy Graham stayed friends to Graham's dying day.
If I sang, he could hear those songs. So I'd sing some of the old crusade songs. This is my story, this is my song. And he'd say, sing more.
Leighton Ford is 87 now. He spent a lot of time thinking about not just how he got to where he is, but what might lie ahead. Here's our conversation. Leighton Ford, you've been an evangelist and you've spent much of your life training and mentoring young evangelists. I feel like that word now carries some connotations that maybe it didn't have when
you were
starting.
It has some freight to it, doesn't it?
It does have some freight. So Why don't you start by telling me sort of what evangelism means to you and sort of what it meant when you were starting out.
I'd be glad to. It's simply good news. It's an interesting word. It comes an old Greek word that means to tell the good news. Now, unfortunately, it's been kind of shipwrecked, you know, and to becoming some which is almost bad news to people. But really what it meant was to share the good news. That's what the angels said when Jesus was born. Here's good news for all people. So, and in fact, when people ask me what an evangelist is, what I do, I like to say, and these are the words of St. Paul, it's making friends for God. I like that. God has changed us from enemies to friends and made us his friends. So it's been that way since I was in my early teens.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a quote on your website that talks about part of your goal is to teach evangelists to be, I think the quote is, kingdom seekers, not empire builders. And do you feel like part of the freight of that word evangelism now is that some people who've gotten into that business who have tried to become empire builders?
And a lot of ego in it and a lot of questionable tactics and ethics in it sometimes, not through the best of them. But evangelists are not just people like Billy Graham or myself who preach from a platform. It's anybody who hears the good news, shares the good news, has something to tell. But yes, some years ago, I felt I'd been preaching around the world, many places, and I met a lot of these young men and women who wanted to share the good news in fresh, vital new ways. And I was at a point where there was a lot of questions about what are true leaders. And there were a lot of leaders who were, I think, empire builders with a lot of ego at the center of it. And if you're going to follow Jesus, he said, if you're going to follow me, you're going to be servants. So how do you, with a servant attitude, seek God's kingdom, not our own? Because that's what it's all about. Jesus said, seek first God's kingdom. It's not about me, not about my church, not about my organization. It's about what God's best is for everyone. But you're right. Also, I'm happen to be a Presbyterian, and people think that's an oxymoron. Presbyterian evangelist. Yeah, but yes, there are a lot of people in all these different groups around the world who share the good news in many ways, and not just people on a platform. In fact, I remember, well, I come back to a story about Billy Graham, if you want.
Absolutely. You go ahead and tell what you got.
My brother had some problems, health problems. He was down at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. And our daughter, Debbie, was going through a second round of breast cancer, and she'd gone down there for some tests. And she went one morning feeling very concerned, very anxious. Down at the end of a hall, there was an old man in a wheelchair waiting. And when she got closer, it was Uncle Billy. He was there for a test. He'd found out where she was going to be and when. And she saw him. She ran to him and leapt in his arms, really. And he hugged her, and he prayed, and they cried together. And not long after, we were up at his home in Montreat. He wasn't well. He was lying in bed. And she sat there and held his hand and said, Uncle Billy, as far as I'm concerned, that was the best sermon you ever preached. It wasn't you on a platform speaking to me down in a crowd. It was me in your wheelchair, me, you're holding me. And that's her memory of him.
I thought it was really interesting and charming, some of the things that I read, some of the things that you wrote after he passed about sort of his quirks and different things that people who might have known him just as a public figure didn't know. One of them seemed to be, the best I could tell, he was a bit of a hypochondriac.
He was. If he got a hanging nail, it was a major problem for him. The family used to say about his wife, Ruth, she'd say, "I've never been better." And Billy would say when he died, "I told you so." My theory was when someone is as famous and well-known as he has to have something to be human. So, and he did have some serious health problems across the years. And he said God used that to keep him humble, to remember it's not about you, Billy.
What were some of the last conversations the two of you had? What were those like?
Up in his mountaintop home in Montreat, when he couldn't speak much anymore, and he couldn't hear. He had a lot of hearing problems later on. And I can remember, while he couldn't hear me speak, because my voice is deep and my wife's voice is quite soft, if I sang, he could hear those songs. So I'd sing some of the old Crusade songs. "This is my story, this is my song." And he'd say, "Sing more."
Yeah. I know that you two worked together, were friends, relatives for a very long time, but I don't really know kind of the origin story. How did you two meet in the first place?
Well, As I said, I grew up in southwestern Ontario in Canada, and I had been asked to lead a youth movement in our hometown. This was back before Billy was famous. He was with Youth for Christ, traveling around, and he came to our little city. I remember a cold January night. Roads were icy. It was snowy, and a little auditorium was packed. And we knew Billy already then had the reputation. After he gave the message and gave the appeal for people to come, they'd come, large numbers. And he spoke that night. It was strong, and he gave that what we used to call the altar call, the invitation.
And just as I am, and that's
yeah,
what I am.
And hardly anybody moved. There was one little girl made a commitment to the Lord, and I was disappointed. And Billy noticed that, and I'll never forget. We went up to the side of the platform, and he put an arm around me, and he said, "I believe God has given you this call to serve Him, and if you stay humble, I believe God will use you. So I'm going to pray for you." And I never forgot that. So I met him first before I met his sister. Of course, later on at college, I met his sister, and we got married, and I was his brother-in-law, so he couldn't fire me.
I want to talk about that, but I want to go back just a little bit. That struck me. I've talked to comedians a lot of times about bombing on stage, the idea that you go up and something that you said that was funny to the last audience, you go the next night, and there's no reaction. As a preacher or somebody, have you had nights where you felt like you bombed and you couldn't figure out why?
Oh, sure. You know, what happened tonight? What was wrong tonight? And I have to remind myself, well, for one thing, it doesn't happen all at once. Maybe I'm just part of someone's spiritual journey. And it's not me. It's the Lord who does it. So, but you can be disappointed. Sure, I can remember times when I've stood there and said, "Isn't anybody going to respond to this?" And I also remember, usually when Billy preached, they used to say he could say Psalm 100 and come forward, and they would. But there were nights that didn't seem quite that much. You know, I also remember he was sick once in England, and he couldn't go for a week, and asked me to come and fill in for him first. And some of the people were so disappointed, and I felt being in his place in this huge football stadium. Years later, I went back to England to speak to some of the young leaders there, and a man said to me, "There were two girls in my office I wanted to bring to hear Billy Graham, and I brought them, and it was a bad, rainy night." And he said, "They said Billy Graham wasn't there. Some bloke named Leighton Ford I never heard of was speaking." He said, "I was so disappointed." But he said, at the end, they went down to the front. And years later, he said, "I want you to know, even though you didn't know it and were disappointed, you know, God used it."
I know you spent some time in the spotlight like that, but most of it, I think people saw Billy as sort of the front person. Did you ever wonder how your life would have been different if you had been the one sort of out front that whole time?
Well, it's a pretty big spotlight. As I'm going to say, it was in Billy's shadow, a pretty big shadow. Well, for the first 5 years, I spent time mostly working with him, helping him in his crusades. Then we had a team that I put together,
sure,
holding crusades across Canada, Australia, New Zealand, some in this country. So I had the privilege of doing that. I wasn't on the same scale as Billy, but I watched him, learn from him. He was a good mentor.
And he officiated your wedding, right?
He said at the end, "Leighton and Jean have exchanged wings instead of rings." Yeah, it didn't.
That seems like one of those slips that actually makes it a little better in some ways.
We've often told that story.
Yeah.
I will tell you one interesting story, though. It used to be in those days, I would go someplace and preach for a week or two, and then Billy would come for the last 2 days. And we're up in eastern Canada, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, on a big outside park up in the Citadel there. And I preached. Billy came in a night early, and he sat at the bank wearing a baseball cap and dark glasses, and people didn't recognize him because of that. So he was sitting there, and I was preaching, and time came at the end, asked people to make a commitment. And he told me later, he saw this old fellow in front of him just kind of nervous and fidgeting around. He figured maybe he was having a spiritual struggle. And so he said, I leaned forward to him and tapped him and said, "Don't you want to go forward and give your life to the Lord tonight?" And he said, the guy turned around, looked at him and said, "Nah, I think I'll wait till the big gun comes tomorrow night."
That's great. So you talked about growing up in Canada and meeting him at this conference. So obviously you were already involved in this sort of work and sort of calling back then. But how early for you did this feel like this is what you were meant to be doing?
Pretty early, Tommy. I'm adopted, and my adopted parents ran a little jewelry store up there in Canada. Gave me a great upbringing, good home. My mother was very devout. She was also very troubled, interestingly. But she taught me about the Lord, places where I'd hear about him, showed me books about preachers and Christian leaders and encouraged me. But I remember, and so early on, I remember as a boy of five putting my hand up in a children's meeting saying, "I want to follow Jesus." But the year I was 14 was a very difficult year because, as I said, she was troubled.
Troubled meaning?
Emotionally troubled, very full of fears of some sort. She was actually classically paranoia, but she was sincere about her faith. And I remember she went away for about 4 months that year, my second last year of high school, and we didn't know where she was. It was a very lonely time. And she came back later that year, and I went to another little youth conference and heard someone talk about prayer, how he prayed walking up and down outside, and he'd read a verse in the Bible and turn it into a prayer. And I remember getting my Bible, going out into the woods. I've been back there. I thought it was a big woods. I've been back there since, and it's not a big woods. It was a small one. But I can remember walking up and down with a big old Bible and opening it up and reading a verse from maybe the Psalms and turn that into a prayer and realizing God was, I felt really present with me and at a very lonely time, very difficult between my father and my mother at that time. And it was that same year that someone came to our hometown to say, "We want to start this Youth for Christ here." And he appointed me as the leader. He thought I was 17 because I was tall. I was only 14, so he about had a heart attack when he learned he'd put this 14-year-old kid in charge of that. So it really came out of, you know, that sense in my life. We'd gone to church, but that God was real, that God cared for me, that I could talk with him. I didn't hear voices back, but I knew I was with him. And out of that came the desire to share that. That's where it began.
And do you feel like that you were looking for something to sort of fill that space when your mom was gone and you were sort of struggling, and that's what filled the space?
I don't know how much I don't know whether it was a spiritual search there or just needing to know safe love, a safe place, which is what we've been trying to provide for these young leaders in recent years, safe times, safe places. So it wasn't that I didn't believe before then, but I believed remotely, let's say, and it seemed like God was much more present.
And as you grew and became, you know, in this position of prominence and did all this work, how did your parents, were they still around when this was happening?
They came back together she came back home till I went off to college, then they split up. She went off and they were never together again. And but they were very supportive of me. My mother didn't want me to go off to college where I went. She had her plans for me, but the Lord had another plan, which included meeting Billy, going to Wheaton College in Illinois, and marrying my wife and moving to North Carolina.
What was her plan?
Her plan was that I would go to the University of Toronto, that she would follow me there, and that together we would have some kind of a, I don't know, whatever. But it wasn't what she planned.
Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I get this. By the time that you sort of grew into your role and were, you know, had met Billy and become known? Were your folks still around? Did they get to see you sort of make it, so to speak?
Somewhat, yes, yes. They not together, but separately.
Sure.
It's a good question. I'm not sure that my adoptive mother ever heard me speak. Maybe once or twice. She moved to another city in Canada. Mm. My father came several times, and he came to Charlotte when we moved here, and heard me preach in a church in Florida, and was very moved by it.
And what was that like to have him in the audience?
He was not a churchgoer. He wasn't anti. It was just, I think maybe my mother turned him away a little bit, actually, with the way she lived out her faith. He was very proud of me, supported me going to school, supported me going to theological seminary. He was very much, even though he was, I'll tell you an interesting thing, George Beverly Shea, you know, was the soloist with Billy, that deep bass voice.
Yes.
And I remember my dad on Sunday nights back in Canada would listen with tears running down his face to the old hymns. So there was something in his heart that was there.
And I remember from doing some research that you eventually, later on, connected with your biological mother, right?
I did.
And when did that happen?
It happened around the time I was 50. It would happen watching Roots. And I got to thinking, I wonder if my birth parents are still alive. Where are they, if I could find them? I had been told that my biological mother was the daughter of an Anglican bishop, which turned out not to be true, but she was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister. And she'd fallen in love. They had a teenage affair. They didn't get married. She gave me up for adoption. So I met her when I was 50. A friend of mine in Canada helped me trace that bank, find a woman, the right name, right age, right place. And he went up to her and said, I have a friend who's looking for his mother. She said, when was he born? 1931. What month? October. She said, October 22. So she said, I'd like to meet him. So I drove up north of Toronto. She was standing outside her little one-story house by a green pine tree waiting. And I got out of the house, went up, put my arms around her, and just said, my mother. And then a year and a half later, I met my father, too. So that was an interesting experience, learning something about my roots that I hadn't known before.
Right. And did you see things or notice things in them that you noticed as being part of you?
My father, my biological father, was a big man. I met him. Turned out he came by Charlotte every year going to Florida from Canada in the wintertime. So he came up 77, and we met right off, Tavola Road. And he was about 6 foot six and weighed about 280 pounds with a shock of white hair. And with his wife, he married someone else later. They came by the house and we visited. And Billy called while he was there. And he didn't know he was there. And Billy said, well, I'd like to talk to him. So his name was Tom. And I said, my brother-in-law wants to speak to you. Well, he got real nervous then because I don't think he was a believer at all. But he went and talked to Billy and came back going, I just talked to Billy Graham. They had a nice visit with that.
When we come back, Leighton Ford talks about the death of his son, how it changed his life and tested his faith. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Well, here we are at halftime of this week's episode, and as always, thank you for listening. If you'd like to be a bigger part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage, which is at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me @TommyTomlinson. It also really helps if you leave us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps Southbound get out there to even more listeners. Thanks again for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Leighton Ford. I want to ask about family because it seems to me that one of the moments that has shaped a lot of what has happened in your life these last 30 years or so has centered around sort of the death of your son. Could you kind of describe what happened and how that changed you?
Our son Sandy, our second child, Debbie was the first, Sandy was the second, and our son Kevin, who will be joining with me, by the way, in our ministry sometime this year.
Oh, great.
Sandy was a runner, and when he was 14, going to AG school, after working out one day, his heart started beating rapidly, and I was out of town, and they called Jeannie. She came and took him to a doctor, and they took him down to the what is now Carolinas Medical Center. I guess that's where they went. He had a thing called WPW syndrome, which is a heart problem, an electrical problem in the heart. It has no governor. So his heart was beating 360 beats a minute. They shocked it back to normalcy, and they did some surgery at Duke to correct the problem, and he went back to school, went off to Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill. And his junior year, the old problem came back again. He went out for a fun run. His heart started beating rapidly. So they said, well, we better do the surgery again, do it right this time. And, of course, we'll never forget, it was the day after Thanksgiving, 1981. Took him early in the morning. I can remember walking down the corridor right to the operating room and squeezing his hand and said, I'll see you later, son. And we waited long, long, long day. And we finally, late afternoon, realized something was not right. And they came in about 6 o'clock that night, very grim, said, we fixed the problem. We couldn't get it to start again. So he was gone. We thought he might not. The problem may still be there. We never thought we'd lose him that day. So it was a huge loss. I can remember the day before I took a walk up by the baseball field up there at Chapel Hill and just stopping and praying, saying, God, please heal him. You can. You're his father. I'd heal him if I could. And I prayed that. And lots of people around the world prayed. But he didn't survive. Can I explain that? No. All I know is a huge loss. Because we were very much alike, we had the same name, we were very much the same temperament, so it was hard. I wrote a book about him called Sandy, A Heart for God, because we saw in him some beauty that I wanted other people to know about. But that did ultimately lead me to say there's another call in my life, and that is to help other young leaders to run their race for the Lord. So we started a Sandy Ford Fund and provided scholarships for many, many hundreds of young men and women to prepare for the ministry. And eventually that led me to leave Billy's work and start Leighton Ford Ministries to help to identify and network together the emerging leaders, not only here but around the world.
You talked about this a little bit just then. I'm sure you've had many, many people who have lost a child or somebody in seemingly inexplicable circumstances come to you for comfort or with questions or with doubts about how God could let this happen, that sort of thing. Maybe some of them knew your circumstances and some didn't. What do you try to say in those moments?
Maybe I don't say much. Maybe just I'm sorry. We lost a son too. I know it hurts, and it does hurt, and it will hurt for a long time. I don't have any explanations. I remember I was speaking at the Renaissance Conference down in Charleston a few years ago, and Rabbi Kushner was there, you know, who wrote Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People?
Sure.
And on a panel, he said, Leighton said, I know you lost a son. Did you know I lost a son, too? And he said, why is it that when something like that happens for some people, their faith seems to grow and stay strong, and others, it just goes the other way. Why is it? And I thought about it, and I said, I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. There's a mystery about some of that. All I know is on the way back from Chapel Hill, was from Durham, from Duke, the night that Sandy died. I looked over at Jeannie sitting next to me, her face so drawn, and she said, well, either there is a God and he does love us, or there's no God. It's just as dark a choice as that. So I went through some very deep waters, but I remember in the Pilgrim's Progress, the major figure of Christian, after he passed over the river, said, I felt the bottom and it's sound. And I know I can't think of anything worse than losing a child. Looking for a place, you don't look for a place to bury your child. But having been through that, to know that God was still there, even as someone wrote to me in the dark place. So I don't have any words of explanation. All I can do, I had to go to Australia not long after that. Didn't want to leave home. I wanted to be with the family, but I had to go. And I remember when I got there and preaching in Sydney, up on the north side of the city, and people said, you don't just sound like a preacher, you sound like a father who's lost a son. I think even though that hole was there and it'll never be filled, I think God used that to make a bridge between my life and others, because we all hurt.
I know this is a time in the world when a lot of people feel lacking in hope, I guess. The Easter story, among other things, is about hope. What do you think of this time of year as this comes back around?
I think it makes me think of Christmas, too, because the incarnation of God becoming human in Jesus, that God is like that. God has come near to us, and that he walked with us. He wept with us. He hurt with us. He loved with us. And that he died. And that's not the end. It's not the end of love or faith or hope. There was the end result was the tomb was empty. And I believe Jesus came alive again. God brought him alive again. And I do have times of doubts. I've been through times, Tommy. I remember one time I was going through a very difficult time at a project in Seattle, Washington. And I got home and told Jeannie, I said, I just don't know if I believe anymore. And she was so helpful. She just let me know how much she loved me. So I've been through those times of doubt. I was a philosophy major, so I've learned all. I don't have all the answers. I think I've asked all the questions. But through all of that, the fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that even the people who his disciples who saw him die, who said and claimed they'd seen him again, actually went to their death believing that. And they could have easily said, we made it all up, but they didn't. And they were changed people. So yes, there is that place of the resurrection that Jesus Christ is alive. I believe that. I believe I'm going to see him again. It's for me the bedrock of my faith. With all of my doubts and questions, and I still have a lot of them.
I want to ask about some of the things you've sort of fallen into one way or the other later on in your career. You just recently published a book of your paintings, and paintings with sort of reflections from your life in the middle of them, and some poetry that you wrote in the middle of that too. So how did all of that happen?
It didn't happen until I was in my 60s. I'm a late comer I liked art, but I'm late comer to not so much to poetry as to art. I was actually in Western Canada, where our son was in graduate school one summer, and I was taking some weeks to do some reading and study, and one day I got bored reading. And the place I was staying, they were away for the summer. The lady was an artist, and she had a book drawing on the creative artist within. And I picked it up and looked at it, and I was fascinated. I had never thought I could draw a circle, a square, a straight line. And the author of this book said, it's all a matter of learning to get on the other side of your brain, drawing the right side of your brain. And she had a book of drawings, and I got that and came back here to Charlotte, bought a book, took a course on the fear of drawing at Queen's, and discovered I loved it. So I do a lot of painting now, mostly watercolor, some pastels. And the new book, Places of the Heart, are places where I have been in these recent years that have spoken to my heart. So I have the paintings there and reflections on the places where I've been and what they've meant to me. I've found for me, too, it's helped me to pay attention more. I have a lot of thoughts, as you probably do, and I get very distracted with them. And to get to the other side of the brain and to stop and look at a scene and see it there and take it in and pause, as Mary Oliver, the poet, said, pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it. So to pay attention to the world around me, instead of just living my head all the time, to use my eyes and stop and look. The great Welsh poet, Gerard Manley Hopkins, is one of my favorites, said, I walk, I lift up heart and eyes to the clouds, and there I can glean my Savior. So to be able to look with eyes like that. So I put down some of those things in that book. I'm glad people have liked it.
Yeah.
And hope they get it. All the proceeds go to our ministry.
No, that's great. Yeah. That's wonderful. So what things do you still feel like are unfinished or new frontiers, things do you still want to try?
Oh, in my life? Oh, wow. What would I like to try? Probably like to try some different kinds of painting. I'll tell you what I am doing right now. When you get to a certain age, you begin forgetting names and you begin forgetting things. So for me, it's memorizing poetry. because I need the mental exercise to keep the brain going and sharp.
Here's the last thing I want to ask you about. You talked very eloquently earlier on about this sort of struggle that I think everybody has between faith and doubt and trying to reconcile those things. And I thought about that very much as Billy Graham went into his last years. All these things that he has preached about and that you have preached about and talked about all these years, as the closer you get to the end, become less and less theoretical and more concrete, where you get to see the other side. That thin veil, as you mentioned with Sandy, at some point is no longer going to be there. And I guess first of all, I have what's probably a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you ever worry that you're wrong?
I do. But I don't think he's wrong. Sure, I have. I do that because I look at myself and say, who am I? I'm one lone mortal. I don't have all the ideas. I don't have all the answers. I can't pretend to have all the answers. But I do believe that Christ has those answers. And if I'm where I've been wrong, he's going to put me right. He's doing it all the time. I'm learning all the time. When I see him, I think he'll say, hey, you were wrong on this, but I love you. Because his love is not a love because of who we are, or that we have all the right answers, but in spite of who we are and because of who God's made us. So, I was asked the other night, I had a showing of my book, new book on Places of the Heart. Someone said, what do you think? Can you paint heaven? I said, no, I can't. I do have a painting there. I wish I could show it to you now. It's at the old gate of Billy's house, standing an old wooden gate standing open. And to me, that was so symbolic. Through that gate, you can see the far hills where Ruth had already gone. And I thought, that's what it is. Jesus is the wide open gate. That's where Billy pointed, not to himself, not to his religion, but to that gate. Ruth's gone through it. Many have gone through it. And we could see in that painting, the gate's open and it's very clear. The far hills are not that clear. So what I see is the gate open now. What I can't see is the mystery of what lies beyond.
One of the things that impressed me the most about Leighton Ford is his willingness to embrace his doubts. He's a believer, obviously, but even at age 87, he doesn't know for sure what lies on the other side. None of the rest of us do either, as much as some of us like to think we do. It seems to me that the more certain people are about what God wants, the more they use that certainty as a club to bash anyone who believes differently or not at all. I consider myself a believer, but I think it's also possible that this life is all we get. I don't understand why we don't spend it doing our best to love one another. No matter what you believe Jesus stands for, that's his message, love one another. In this life, that's about the best we can do. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jessa O'Connor. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you like to listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.
On the next episode of Southbound, we talked to Tony Jack, who came out of a poor neighborhood in Miami and is now a professor at Harvard. He's written a book about how elite universities can help kids in poverty thrive.
What does it mean for me to be a Head Start kid, to have grown up in West Grove, to be the son of a security guard, the grandson of a maid, to be sitting in Harvard with, you know, the Harvard robe on my desk, I mean, on my wall, as a Harvard professor. And I just think about how improbable that journey is.
That's coming in 2 weeks on our next episode of Southbound.